Chapter 38. Associating intimately with members of the bench and bar. This is excellent. But what is Mr. Collins' explanation? Perhaps the simplest solution of the problem is to accept the hypothesis that in early life he was in an attorney's office, that he there contracted a love for the law which never left him, that as a young man in London he continued to study or dabble in it for his amusement, to stroll in leisure hours into the courts, and to frequent the society of lawyers. On no other supposition is it possible to explain the attraction which the law evidently had for him, and his minute and undeviating accuracy in a subject where no layman who has indulged in such copious and ostentatious display of legal technicalities has ever yet succeeded in keeping himself from tripping. A lame conclusion. Oh, other supposition indeed. Yes, there is another, and a very obvious supposition, namely, that Shakespeare was himself a lawyer, well versed in his trade, versed in all the ways of the courts, and living in close intimacy with judges and members of the Inns of Court. One is, of course, thankful that Mr. Collins has appreciated the fact that Shakespeare must have had a sound legal training, but I may be forgiven if I do not attach quite so much importance to his pronouncements on this branch of the subject as to those of Malone, Lord Campbell, Judge Holmes, Mr. Castle, K.C.C., Lord Penzance, Mr. Grant White, and other lawyers who have expressed their opinion on the matter of Shakespeare's legal acquirements. Here it may, perhaps, be worthwhile to quote again from Lord Penzance's book as to the suggestion that Shakespeare had somehow or other managed to acquire a perfect familiarity with legal principles and an accurate and ready use of the technical terms and phrases, not only of the conveyancer's office, but of the pleader's chambers and the courts at Westminster. This, as Lord Penzance points out, would require nothing short of employment in some career involving constant contact with legal questions and general legal work. But in what portion of Shakespeare's career would it be possible to point out that time could be found for the interposition of a legal employment in the chambers or offices of practicing lawyers? It is beyond doubt that at an early period he was called upon to abandon his attendance at school and assist his father, and was soon after, at the age of 16, bound apprentice to a trade. While under the obligation of this bond he could not have pursued any other employment. Then he leaves Stratford and comes to London. He has to provide himself with the means of a livelihood, and this he did in some capacity at the theatre. No one doubts that. The holding of horses is scouted by many, and perhaps with justice, as being unlikely and certainly unproved. But whatever the nature of his employment was at the theater, there is hardly room for the belief that it could have been other than continuous, for his progress there was so rapid. Ere long he had been taken into the company as an actor, and was soon spoken of as a Johannes factotum. His rapid accumulation of wealth speaks volumes for the constancy and activity of his services. One fails to see when there could be a break in the current of his life at this period of it, giving room or opportunity for legal, or indeed any other employment. In 1589, says Knight, we have undeniable evidence that he had not only a casual engagement, was not only a salaried servant, as May players were, but was a shareholder in the company of the Queen's players with other shareholders below him on the list. This 1589 would be within 2 years after his arrival in London, which is placed by White and Halliwell Phillips about the year 1587. The difficulty in supposing that, starting with a state of ignorance in 1587, when he is supposed to have come to London, he was induced to enter upon a course of most extended study and mental culture, is almost insuperable. Still, it was physically possible, provided always that he could have had access to the needful books. But this legal training seems to me to stand on a different footing. It is not only unaccountable and incredible, but it is actually negatived by the known facts of his career. Lord Penzance then refers to the fact that Y 1592, according to the best authority, Mr. Grant White, several of the plays had been written. The Comedy of Errors in 1589, Love's Labour's Lost in 1589, Two Gentlemen of Verona in 1589 or 1590, and so forth, and then asks, with this catalogue of dramatic work on hand, was it possible that he could have taken a leading part in the management and conduct of two theaters, and if Mr. Phillips is to be relied upon, taken his share in the performances of the provincial tours of his company and at the same time, devoted himself to the study of the law in all its branches so efficiently, as to make himself complete master of its principles and practice, and saturate his mind with all its most technical terms? I have cited this passage from Lord Penzance's book, because it lay before me, and I had already quoted from it on the matter of Shakespeare's legal knowledge. But other writers have still better set forth the insuperable difficulties, as they seem to me, which beset the idea that Shakespeare might have found them in some unknown period of early life, amid multifarious other occupations, for the study of classics, literature, and law, to say nothing of languages and a few other matters. Lord Penzance further asks his readers, did you ever meet with, or hear of an instance in which a young man in this country gave himself up to legal studies and engaged in legal employments, which is the only way of becoming familiar with the technicalities of practice, unless with the view of practicing in that profession? I do not believe that it would be easy, or indeed possible, to produce an instance in which the law has been seriously studied in all its branches, except as a qualification for practice in the legal profession. This testimony is so strong, so direct, so authoritative, and so uncheapened, unwatered by guesses, and surmises, and maybe so's, and might have beens, and could have beens, and mustache have beens, and the rest of that ton of plaster of Paris out of which the biographers have built the colossal brontosaur which goes by the Stratford actor's name, that it quite convinces me that the man who wrote Shakespeare's works knew all about law and lawyers. Also, that that man could not have been the Stratford Shakespeare and wasn't. Who did write these works then? I wish I knew. -1. From Chapter 13. Of the Shakespeare Problem Restated. By George G. Greenwood, M. P. John Lane Company, Publishers. X. Did Francis Bacon write Shakespeare's works? Nobody knows. We cannot say we know a thing, when that thing has not been proved. Know is too strong a word, to use when the evidence is not final and absolutely conclusive. We can infer, if we want to, like those slaves. No, I will not write that word, it is not kind, it is not courteous. The upholders of the Stratford Shakespeare superstition call us the hardest names they can think of, and they keep doing it all the time. Very well, if they like to descend to that level, let them do it, but I will not so undignify myself as to follow them. I cannot call them harsh names. The most I can do is to indicate them by terms reflecting my disapproval, and this without malice, without venom. To resume, what I was about to say was, those thugs have built their entire superstition upon inferences, not upon known and established facts. It is a weak method, and poor, and I am glad to be able to say our side never resorts to it, while there is anything else to resort to. But when we must, and we have now arrived at a place of that sort. Since the Stratford Shakespeare couldn't have written the works, we infer that somebody did. Who was it, then? This requires some more inferring. Ordinarily when an unsigned poem sweeps across the continent like a tidal wave whose roar and boom and thunder are made up of admiration, delight, and applause, a dozen obscure people rise up and claim the authorship. Why a dozen, instead of only one or two? One reason is because there are a dozen that are recognizably competent to do that poem. Do you remember Beautiful Snow? Do you remember Rock Me to Sleep, Mother, Rock Me to Sleep? Do you remember Backward, Turn, Backward, O Time, In Thy Flight? Make Me a Child Again Just for Tonight? I remember them very well. Their authorship was claimed by most of the grown-up people who were alive at the time, and every claimant had one plausible argument in his favor, at least, to wit, he could have done the authoring. He was competent. Have the works been claimed by a dozen? They haven't. There was good reason. The world knows there was but one man on the planet at the time who was competent, not a dozen, and not two. A long time ago, the dwellers in a far country used now and then to find a procession of prodigious footprints stretching across the plain, footprints that were 3 miles apart, each footprint a third of a mile long and a furlong deep, and with forests and villages mashed to mush in it. Was there any doubt as to who made that mighty trail? Were there a dozen claimants? Were there two? No, the people knew who it was that had been along there. There was only one Hercules. There has been only one Shakespeare. There couldn't be two. Certainly there couldn't be two at the same time. It takes ages to bring forth a Shakespeare, and some more ages to match him. This one was not matched before his time, nor during his time, and hasn't been matched since. The prospect of matching him in our time is not bright. The Baconians claim that the Stratford Shakespeare was not qualified to write the works, and that Francis Bacon was. They claim that Bacon possessed the stupendous equipment, both natural and acquired, for the miracle, and that no other Englishman of his day possessed the like, or, indeed, anything closely approaching it. Macaulay, in his essay, has much to say about the splendor and horizonless magnitude of that equipment. Also, he has synopsized Bacon's history, a thing which cannot be done for the Stratford Shakespeare, for he hasn't any history to synopsize. Bacon's history is open to the world, from his boyhood to his death in old age, a history consisting of known facts, displayed in minute and multitudinous detail. Facts, not guesses and conjectures and might-have-beens. Whereby it appears that he was born of a race of statesmen, and had a Lord Chancellor for his father, and a mother who was distinguished both as a linguist and a theologian. She corresponded in Greek with Bishop Jewell, and translated his Apologia from the Latin so correctly that neither he nor Archbishop Parker could suggest a single alteration. It is the atmosphere we are reared in that determines how our inclinations and aspirations shall tend. The atmosphere furnished by the parents to the son in this present case was an atmosphere saturated with learning, with thinkings and ponderings upon deep subjects, and with polite culture. It had its natural effect. Shakespeare of Stratford was reared in a house which had no use for books, since its owners, his parents, were without education. This may have had an effect upon the son, but we do not know, because we have no history of him of an informing sort. There were but few books anywhere, in that day, and only the well-to-do and highly educated possessed them, they being almost confined to the dead languages. LL The valuable books then extant in all the vernacular dialects of Europe would hardly have filled a single shelf, imagine it. The few existing books were in the Latin tongue mainly. Person who was ignorant of it was shut out from all acquaintance, not merely with Cicero and Virgil, but with the most interesting memoirs, state papers, and pamphlets of his own time, a literature necessary to the Stratford lad, for his fictitious reputation's sake, since the writer of his works would begin to use it wholesale, and in a most masterly way before the lad was hardly more than out of his teens and into his twenties. At 15, Bacon was sent to the university, and he spent 3 years there. Thence he went to Paris in the train of the English ambassador, and there he mingled daily with the wise, the cultured, the great, and the aristocracy of fashion, during another 3 years. A total of 6 years spent at the sources of knowledge both of books and of men. The three spent at the university were coeval with the second and last three spent by the little Stratford lad at Stratford School, supposedly, and perhapsedly, and maybe, and by inference with nothing to infer from. The second three of the Baconian six were presumably spent by the Stratford lad as apprentice to a butcher. That is, the thugs presume it on no evidence of any kind. Which is their way, when they want a historical fact. Fact and presumption are, for business purposes, all the same to them. They know the difference, but they also know how to blink it. They know, too, that while in history building a fact is better than a presumption, it doesn't take a presumption long to bloom into a fact when they have the handling of it. They know by old experience that when they get hold of a presumption - tadpole, he is not going to stay tadpole in their history tank. No, they know how to develop him into the giant four-legged bullfrog of fact, and make him sit up on his hams, and puff out his chin, and look important, and insolent, and come to stay, and assert his genuine Simon pure authenticity with a thundering bellow that will convince everybody, because it is so loud. The thug is aware that loudness convinces 60 persons, where reasoning convinces but one. I wouldn't be a thug, not even if, but never mind about that, it has nothing to do with the argument, and it is not noble in spirit besides. If I am better than a thug, is the merit mine? No, it is his. Then to him be the praise. That is the right spirit. They resume the lad severed his resumed connection with the Stratford school to become apprentice to a butcher. They also resume that the butcher was his father. They don't know. There is no written record of it, nor any other actual evidence. If it would have helped their case any, they would have apprenticed him to 30 butchers, to 50 butchers, to a wilderness of butchers, all by their patented method resumption. If it will help their case, they will do it yet, and if it will further help it, they will presume that all those butchers were his father. And the week after, they will say it. Why, it is just like being the past tense of the compound reflexive adverbial incandescent hypodermic irregular accusative noun of multitude, which is father to the expression which the grammarians call verb. It is like a whole ancestry, with only one posterity. To resume. Next, the young Bacon took up the study of law, and mastered that abstruse science. From that day to the end of his life he was daily in close contact with lawyers and judges, not as a casual onlooker in intervals between holding horses in front of a theater, but as a practicing lawyer, a great and successful one, a renowned one, a lancelot of the bar, the most formidable lance in the high brotherhood of the legal table round. He lived in the law's atmosphere thenceforth, all his years, and by sheer ability forced his way up its difficult steeps to its supremest summit, the Lord Chancellorship, leaving behind him no fellow craftsman qualified to challenge his divine right to that majestic place. When we read the praises bestowed by Lord Penzance, and the other illustrious experts upon the legal condition and legal aptnesses, brilliances, profundities, and felicities so prodigally displayed in the plays, and try to fit them to the historyless Stratford stage manager, they sound wild, strange, incredible, ludicrous. But when we put them in the mouth of Bacon, they do not sound strange, they seem in their natural and rightful place, they seem at home there. Please turn back, and read them again. Attributed to Shakespeare of Stratford, they are meaningless. They are inebriate extravagancies, intemperate admirations of the dark side of the moon, so to speak. Attributed. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.